The wolves did not eat the sheep, and the sheep were not afraid of the wolves. He was puzzled and asked, "How is it that these wolves get along so well with these sheep?" Mimana answered, "I have improved my relations with my lord, and my lord has improved the relations between the sheep and the wolves." Every mother should ask herself, when she has trouble with her children, whether the real reason for it is that she is neglecting her relationship with God. What is true at the level of the family is equally true at the level of society. Purely human means such as a knowledge of psychology, teaching ability, authority and prestige, are powerless to bring about unity among men, in whom a virus of disunion has been embedded since original sin. Above all, they are powerless to bring about the unity in charity which Christ demands so insistently. The unity of the children of God is a work that only Christ can accomplish, and which he effectuates by sending the Holy Spirit. It was only after Pentecost that the disciples were said to be of one heart and one mind, Acts 4:32. No one can be a worthy builder of unity unless he opens himself freely to the Spirit of God. How? By receiving the sacraments, but also through mental prayer. Without this prayer, the Holy Spirit who is given to us in the sacraments comes up against closed doors. Thanks to mental prayer, the Spirit's ascendancy becomes stronger and deeper with each passing day, and unity gradually becomes a reality. This unity is realized within us, for it is first of all within us that the uproar and division reign, but it is realized around us as well. Then apostolic action proves its efficacy, not only in encouraging our brothers and sisters individually to serve the Lord, but also in achieving the unity of the children of God. It is this unity that Christ revealed as his deepest wish, during his great farewell prayer among his friends. Make room for mental prayer in your life, and, I am sure, you will be able to write to me, "I have improved my relations with my Lord, and my Lord has improved the relations among my young lions, whom I hope soon to call my young lambs." 66. In the Breach. During the heat of the day, as the patriarch sat at the entrance of his tent, he looked up and saw three men, in reality Yahweh and two angels. He stood up, bowed low, and offered them hospitality. Then Yahweh renewed his promise to give him descendants, and disclosed to him that he was on his way to Sodom and Gomorrah to judge them. Abraham then became the advocate of the criminal cities before God. His prayer, the first that we read in the Bible cf. Gen 18:23-32, is a trusting, skillful, bold and pathetic intercession on behalf of the guilty. Abraham thus inaugurated the long line of intercessors who were to succeed one another in Israel from age to age. About six centuries later, we might call Moses the prototype intercessor. Weary of his people's unbelief, Yahweh declares to Moses, "Let me alone, then, that my wrath may blaze up against them to consume them. Then I will make of you a great nation." Ex 32:10. From the first words, we understand that Moses is the one who does not let God alone do as he pleases. Nor does Moses agree to break off relations with his people, even to receive a more glorious regency. He is the leader of these people by God's will, and so he will be their defender, their intercessor before the Lord himself. Judges, kings and prophets, in the footsteps of Abraham and Moses, pleaded in their turn for this stiff-necked people and obtained mercy for them many times. But woe to the centuries when God found no intercessor, have searched among them for someone who could build a wall or stand in the breach before me to keep me from destroying the land, but I found no one. Ex 22:30. Admire this portrait of the intercessor. He is the man who builds a rampart to protect his brothers, and keeps watch in the breach through which punishment might come. Actually, all these intercessors of our Bible are but figures, rough drafts of the great and only intercessor, Jesus Christ. Here is the man whom God is seeking. Standing in the breach, both arms outstretched, He intervenes more effectively than Abraham. He pleads for the criminal world. And because he has united himself to human nature in the incarnation, et verbum caro factum est, human nature has been reconciled with the Father for all time. Once and for all, Jesus Christ offered himself, and rebuilt the bridge between mankind and God. In a sense, his mission as an intercessor is completed. But it is equally true that he wants to continue his function of intercession on earth until the end of time. In order to accomplish this, he depends on us, his disciples. It is now our turn to remain in the breach, and keep watch. It is our turn to plead for the vast multitude of men and women everywhere, but first and in a special way for the people among whom it is our predestined mission to incarnate Christ and carry on his intercession. Several times in my priestly life, I thought I discerned the Lord's strategy. In order not to turn away from a certain sinful family, from a certain de-Christianized village, he raises up within them a prayerful person. And he blesses the place, the human group, where he has a beloved child. It may be a crippled young man, a humble peasant girl, or a poor country pastor afire with prayer. The prayer of these intercessors is none other than Christ's own prayer. Otherwise it would be nothing. It is the prayer of Christ kindled within them by the Spirit of Christ, one of whose proper names is Paraclete, Advocate, Defender, Intercessor. Undoubtedly, while the Holy Spirit pleads for those in whom he dwells, he also intercedes for all mankind in them and through them. The glorious Christ, at the right hand of the Father, translates in heaven everything that all intercessors, inspired by the Spirit, ask in their deficient human language on earth. For the risen Lord lives and never ceases interceding for us. Cf. IJN 2:I, Heb 7:25. Intercession is truly one of the great words in the vocabulary of prayer. It is a truly sublime function. It witnesses at once to a great love of God, and to a great love of men. 67. With outstretched arms. I have just reread, in Le Visage de Monfrey, My Brother's Face, by D.G. Mukji, a page that brings out the great power of prayer. Here is a summary of its essential points. Toward the end of his life, a holy man withdrew into a mountain cave in order to be better able to find God. The peasants of the vicinity never failed to have fruit and biscuits brought to him, and sometimes they would go up the mountain to him themselves. The youths protested against these prodigal gifts for a useless man. But the old men silenced the young rationalists. We must send offerings to a holy man, whether or not he lives for the good of anyone. Isn't holiness the great jewel of existence? After 20 years, one day the holy man was found dead, lying at the entrance of the cave. 6 weeks later, a terrible crime was committed in the village. Everyone was filled with disgust and fear. The elders went off to fast and pray. Suddenly one of them cried out, "I've discovered the secret." Standing before the assembled peasants, he explained what he meant. "It's true that the holy man never lifted a finger to help us the whole time he lived in his cave, or brought succor to the destitute, or cared for even one sick person. But virtue begot virtue, life brought forth a better life. All was well with us. Not a single man took his brother's life as long as the saint lived. Isn't it all very clear? He never worked for us, but his lion's presence kept the wolf of misfortune away from our doors." This story reminds us irresistibly of a great page of the Bible in chapters VI of Exodus. At Rephidim, Amalek came and waged war against Israel. Moses, therefore, said to Joshua, "Pick out certain men, and tomorrow go out and engage Amalek in battle. I will be standing on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him. He engaged Amalek in battle after Moses had climbed to the top of the hill with Aaron and Hur. As long as Moses kept his hands raised up, Israel had the better of their fight, but when he let his hands rest, Amalek had the better of their fight. Moses' hands, however, grew tired, so they put a rock in place for him to sit on. Meanwhile Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. And Joshua mowed down Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword, Ex 17:8-13. Amalek's soldiers could not understand what power was resisting their impetuous attacks. The Israelite army, badly trained and much smaller than theirs, could not account for the resistance. It never occurred to them that the man scarcely visible at the top of the hill, more poorly armed than his own troops, was the cause of their defeat. God was present in him, because he was praying. And the divine omnipotence that emanated from him strengthened his men for combat and protected them like an invisible and inviolable rampart. We can fully understand the two stories I have just recounted, only in the light of the gospel. On another hill a man also stretched out his arms. Two nails held them up. And from him, God's power was poured out upon the world. There is nothing in space or time that escapes this power, the Holy Spirit. It sustains in their combats all who welcome it and surrender to it. In them this power works mightily, and through them it overwhelms the demons and their cohorts. Moses' prayer and the prayer of the holy man of India were efficacious because the power that manifested itself at Calvary came to them, without their knowing just what it was. The prayer of Christians is powerful because it is united to the inexhaustible wellspring of divine energy, the heart of the crucified praying his great filial prayer. 68. To pray is to cooperate with God. S. I read your letter, I thought, why not answer the questions of a Protestant by a Protestant? I picked up a book in my library that I have reread many times, and which has always given me renewed inspiration to pray. I refer to Le Problème de la Prière, The Problem of Prayer, by Finan Menegas. Certainly, I do not agree with all of this author's theses. But what fervent conviction, what faith in the primordial importance of prayer! Here is the very importance that, you're right, seems to escape you. The core of his message stems from the purest biblical tradition. It is condensed in one of the many definitions of prayer that can be gleaned from his book. Christian prayer is the cry of a heart conquered by the grace of the sovereign God, whose supreme joy is to cooperate with God and to see the divine work of salvation triumph in human society. There is a danger that we will accept this definition without measuring its full significance. The author, for his part, did not hesitate to deploy considerable erudition to justify it throughout the 500 pages of his book. He first attacks an error that he considers to be the most formidable of all. This consists in speaking of Christian prayer solely from man's point of view. It is as if a prayer were only one human activity among others, which man could perform left to his own resources. It is as if God were just another person, to whom we address our requests, and remain on good terms with, but who remains external to us. Finan Menegas forces us to reverse our perspective. In many different ways, he repeats that in order to understand prayer we have to start out not from man, but from God. We have to start from God at work in the world and in each of us, accomplishing the work of salvation. Saint Paul presents this to us in a vigorous synthesis in the first chapter of the Epistle to the Ephesians, the gathering together in his risen Son of all those who open themselves to his grace through faith. This God, who never ceases his work of forgiving, regenerating, and saving, invites the believer to work with him. And that's what prayer is, cooperating with God, so that in each one of us the work of God may be realized, his name be blessed, his kingdom come, and his will be done. Such a prayer is fundamentally devoid of self-interest. In place of the principle that tends to make the Godhead the servant of man, It substitutes the opposite principle that makes man the totally dependent servant of God.